This is Eagle 1490 AM WLCX La Crosse and streaming everywhere on the Civic Media app.
ABC News, I'm Dave Packer. More mysterious drone sightings over a number of states, including New York, New Jersey, Pennsylvania, and Virginia.
The aircraft now getting the attention of public officials. Mendham Borough Mayor Christine Serrano has organized a task force to track, record, and share drone sightings.
At this rate, they need to let us know if it's their equipment, if our government owns this. And that's it.
In a bulletin obtained by ABC News, the New Jersey Division of Fire Safety warning downed or landed drones should not be approached.
ABC's Ike Ajachi. New details in the killing of United Healthcare CEO Brian Thompson. Police now say the suspect did not take a bus, took the train to Pennsylvania. And we've learned that the FBI and NYPD spoke to Luigi Mangione's mother a day before he was arrested. American Travis Timmerman handed over to the U.S. after months in a Syrian prison. But there's no word yet on the whereabouts of American Austin Tice. This is ABC News. A health scare for Nancy Pelosi.
We're told that the former Speaker of the House sustained a hip injury after falling down some stairs and is likely to require surgery. She is currently hospitalized there in Luxembourg. She was traveling with that group of lawmakers there to commemorate the 80th anniversary of the Battle of the Bulge. The question is whether or not Pelosi, who is 84 years old, would get the surgery if necessary there in Europe, or whether she would first come home and have the surgery here in the United States.
ABC's Jonathan Carl. A California couple is dead after being shot and killed while out of the country. ABC's Alex Stone has details.
50-year-old Gloria Ambries and 53-year-old Rafael Cardona were sitting in a Ford pickup truck when they were shot and killed while on vacation in Michoacan, Mexico. A local mayor is married to Cardona's sister. Mexican police say forensic experts are reviewing ballistic evidence and that an investigation is underway. Alex Stone, ABC News.
And I'm Dave Packer, ABC News.
I'm Dan Schaefer. Let's recombobulate. Big news in Wisconsin this month, as much of the controversial anti-union Act 10 law was struck down in a ruling by Dane County Circuit Court Judge Jacob Frost. Two takeaways on this. One, the ruling gets at the heart of what has always made this law so brazenly political, by defining public safety employees differently from general public employees. That decision was pretty clearly made not based on across-the-board policy, but on which unions backed Scott Walker for governor in 2010. It would be fitting if that is what ultimately spells the end for this controversial law. Secondly, this case is headed to an appeal, which almost certainly will end up at the Wisconsin Supreme Court. While this case still might be decided by the court's current 4-3 liberal majority, it's a good reminder of just how important the upcoming race for state Supreme Court will be.
Find all of Dan's work at the Recombobulation Area and on our website at civicmedia.us. You can always continue the conversation on social media. Share your thoughts when you find and follow Civic Media on Facebook, X, and Instagram.
For Civic Media News, I'm Savannah Tomei Olson. The lawsuit over Act 10 will almost certainly end up in front of the Wisconsin Supreme Court, intensifying the race for a seat on the bench in the spring. Here's Judith Ruiz Branch.
The judge ruled Act 10 is unconstitutional because it treats different groups of public employees unequally. The controversial 13-year-old law strictly limits public sector bargaining rights in Wisconsin. Michael Childers is a labor education professor at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. He says the law also brought the state back more than 50 years, as Wisconsin was a pioneer in the fight for workers' legal rights.
It was the first state in the nation that allowed formally for public sector bargaining and then became the first to basically greatly curtail bargaining rights for all but police and fire in the state.
Act 10 would be struck down pending a final decision by the Wisconsin Supreme Court, which currently has a liberal majority. The Republican-controlled legislature that appealed the recent decision is hoping to drag out the case. But the public workers who challenged the law hope the court rules before a new justice is seated next year. Wisconsin's public sector laws of 1959 and 1962 are regarded as turning points in the legal rights of workers. Childers says Wisconsin's union participation was always higher than the national average until the passage of Act 10 in 2011.
They had rights similar to what most workers in the private sector in the United States enjoyed, which is the ability to bargain over hours, wages, and all other conditions of work.
Childers says Wisconsin experienced the largest decline of union membership in the U.S. over the past decade. For Wisconsin News Connection, I'm Judith Ruiz Branch. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
You're listening to Civic Media News. I'm Savannah Tomei Olson.
Enjoying this local program? Find the complete Civic Media lineup at civicmedia.us or the Civic Media app.
La Crosse area weather. I'm Corey Hartman. Winter weather advisory today. Snow and freezing rain and a little bit breezy as well. Highs in the mid-30s. For tonight, snow and drizzle coming to an end later with a low around 32. Tomorrow, mostly cloudy. Highs near 40 degrees. More rain and snow Monday.
It's 30 at our studios.
Dive into the heart of community issues with Lean Local, hosted by former Green Bay Mayor Jim Schmidt. Lean Local focuses on what truly matters in our neighborhoods and communities. Lean Local with Jim Schmidt, Sundays at 1 on 97.9 WGBW.
You're listening to The Eagle, WLCX, Lacrosse's home for the Todd Allball Show.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
Welcome to the Cripescast. I'm your host, Charlie Behrens. We are powered by Everlight Solar, and here's this week's episode. Folks, welcome to the Cripescast. This week we are talking about Aldo Leopold. He is one of the greatest conservationists ever to live. He is born in Iowa, but I think Wisconsin's going to claim him. As a Wisconsinite, I'll just say he's Wisconsinite. One of the greatest ecological writers of our time. A Sand County Almanac is celebrating 75 years this year, and we are talking with Buddy Heffaker, who is the president and executive director of the Aldo Leopold Foundation. He's been there for 20 years. Great guy. He's also essentially in charge with taking care of Aldo's farm, the land that he based a lot of a Sand County Almanac off of. And in addition to the great environmental work the foundation is continuing to do today, we dive into all that. But a lot of this is really just diving into the work of Aldo Leopold and what he has done to essentially getting your average person to care about the environment, which I think he did successfully 75 years ago. And that work is still needs to be done and still is being done. So anyway, we have a real fun conversation, and I hope you enjoy it. And before we get to that conversation, I want to remind you, we're still raising money for Doctors Without Borders. You can go to doctorswithoutborders.org to donate today. Thank you all for listening. And here's my conversation with Buddy Heffaker. Thank you so much for coming on.
Excited to be able to be in conversation.
So 75 years, Sand County Almanac is celebrating an anniversary this year. And what do you think it is about this book and Aldo Leopold that has transcended decade after decade after decade of environmentalists and conservationists?
Well, I think, Charlie, you got to start with just Leopold's excellent writing. I mean, you know, he conveys complicated scientific ideas into just kind of really elegant little poems almost. And I like to say he kind of just captures what a lot of us feel when we're outdoors looking at wildlife, hunting, fishing, hiking. And he just can say it better than any of us. And so when you read his writing, You kind of immediately like, oh, yeah, that's what I think. That's how I feel. But I just can't say it that well.
Sand County Almanac is a book that I read, I don't know, in college. And then I've always had, it's like one that sits on the shelf and you don't really. But my sister actually just gave me a copy of it again for, because she was staying at my place. And it was really cool. So I just started reading it again and kind of rediscovering it a little bit. And there was this one passage, I think it was early on in the sort of collection of essays, and it was about cutting down this tree at his farm, and he goes through all the ring. The tree had been struck by lightning, and it starts off with him burning the wood, and it goes from burning the wood to thinking about cutting the tree down, and then cutting the tree down. It's him and the guy with the saw, and they're cutting through these rings of the tree. So he goes back in time, and each ring of the tree talks about what happened, what that tree saw, and how that tree saw, like, the last elks leave. Yep. The Midwest, or I mean, there were elks there, you know. Even Elkhart, Indiana used to be named Elkhart, Indiana, you know. And so he just goes back in time, just using the rings of the trees. And then I was out in the garage right before this, actually, just sawing a 4x4, and I looked down and I got the center piece. So you're looking at the rings, and I thought about that. So, I mean, it connects in such a cool way. Everybody knows the rings of the trees, and everybody can go back in time, and sort of he picks out these historical references and shows the decline of the turkey from Wisconsin. Yeah. Back then. And reading it now, you know, the turkey has come back, but other things have left Wisconsin. So it's just the idea of time and of what we've lost and what we've regained as a society. It's just cool. It's cool to see.
Yeah, I think, and that's one of the best essays, The Good Oak. And he does a great job, like you say, of kind of capturing a moment in the 1940s, really, when things were kind of grim for the outdoors and conservation. We were losing the elk and the turkey. And he, you know, his essay, Marshland Elegy, presumes that sandhill cranes are going to go extinct, or at least get removed from the state of Wisconsin. And so now we can read, like, this call that, hey, we got to wake up and take care of these things, that make sure we have clean air, clean water, healthy wildlife habitats. And we have some success stories. We have cranes back. We have turkeys back. We have elk back. So it's really kind of fun to read this really insightful ecologist who could assess the time and look back and then assess where we've come and where we still have to go.
Yeah. Yeah. It's cool to find that combination of a great writer and environmental, you know, ecologist. I don't even know if environmentalist was a thing back then, but that's what it takes in order to, like, break through. I mean, I feel like, how do you feel right now the environmental movement is in terms of conveying the importance of the issue? Because how many years in a row have we heard that, like, what is it? The clock, the doomsday clock is,
yeah,
it is seconds closer to nothing really breaks through on the environment. I don't think I think it, well, let me just say it. It's harder to get stuff on the environment to break through. And I'm not sure why, because it's something that affects us all. And yet we all collectively kind of don't care.
Yeah, you know, it's really interesting. I think Leopold would have suggested that was true even when he was writing his book, right? Like, he was writing it asking people to care, and kind of it was the culmination of decades of working and not getting people to care or think about these things. So I think the challenge may still be the same. Leopold also had the benefit of, he was writing when there just weren't as many other voices out there, both positive to care about these things, and, you know, the challenges of competing with social media and all this kind of information flow that we get as individuals these days. So I think it's just a more competitive environment, kind of, so to speak. And then, you know, it's really just kind of an ongoing interesting dilemma, because surveys show people actually care more about the environment and know more about the environment and how it operates than ever before in history. And yet, what does that mean? How do we actually take care of it? It's still so challenging and complicated that we're not making the progress we probably need to on several fronts.
Yeah, I think that is true. I think people do. If you ask them, is it an issue, should we take care of it? I think yes and yes. I think what you probably just have is industry is really good at sort of saying they're doing the environmentally right thing, but then not really doing the environmentally right thing. And collectively as a whole, we're all guilty of it. I'm very guilty, yeah, of it. I fly for my work, you know, and all that sort of stuff. So, but it's the idea of you know, saying this is recyclable, for instance, for plastic, knowing damn well it is not going to get recycled and that only a very small percentage of plastic bottles actually get recycled. But people feel like they're doing the right thing. So I think the game has become less about getting people to care about it, because people now care about it. So then those companies realize that and they're like, all right, let's give them some to allow them to keep using our product, like greenwashing or whatever, even though we know this is just making the problem harder. So it's like continuing to re-educate and like break through. And it's tough. It's tough. I think people don't respond well to facts necessarily. It's more emotion. Bringing back to Aldo Leopold, that was what he was really good at, was about getting to the emotion of it.
Well, yeah, I think it's several things you point out there. One is, yeah, Leopold was ultimately a storyteller, right? He was trying to create these little vignettes that people, whether you're cutting a tree down or watching a crane fly by or out hunting grouse, that you would think about your connection to the natural world and how you, you know, should care about it and for it. And so there's science in the book, but it's not really a scientific book, right? It's a book of essays and stories that help bring to life the land around us. And then the other thing is, and Leopold realized this, it's not easy. You know, one of my favorite lines out of the book is, in our attempt to make conservation easy, we've made it trivial. And it's not trivial. It is really damn hard. As you just pointed out, like there are all these things that kind of work against us and kind of motivate bad behavior. And to line up our values and our economies and our ecosystems, that just ain't easy to do.
It's funny. It's funny because what he just said in that sentence was exactly what I was rambling on for, like, ever trying to say. Speaking of which, he has a really good knack of summing up a whole thing with just one sentence. Like, there's this one sentence that I love, sort of in the age of AI, really, and this information age, is what a dull world if we knew all about geese. You know, it's like one of my favorite lines in the whole thing, just because there's, you know, I think we're all chasing this like all knowing thing, this thing that will work for us essentially. And then what a dull world it would be, you know, with taking out the mystery. But at the same time, you see humanity wants to progress and keep going down these roads. And what do you think the marriage is between technology and the environment? And what do you think Aldo Leopold would say were he alive today about sort of what's going on with AI, the amount of carbon that takes, and also the potential for AI to help resolve some complicated environmental issues?
Yeah, you know, I mean, this is a line not out of a Sand County Almanac, but out of his other writings, where he describes the oldest task in human history is to live on a piece of land without spoiling it. And in that essay, he's talking about how technology and innovation kind of make our lives better, and yet, if we're not careful, in the end, kind of undermine, you know, what really makes a good life. And so he was always a little suspicious of technology. And I think what he was really just asking us to do is be more thoughtful and more intentional about where and how we allow technology into our lives, so it's working for us, not kind of knowingly or unknowingly against us. And I think that's where getting the frame right is still the real challenge. And I'll quote another Wisconsinite, Gaylord Nelson, former governor and senator of the state of Wisconsin, the conceiver of and kind of founder of Earth Day. So, I mean, I don't know your age, Charlie, but I haven't known a world that hasn't included Earth Day. Like it happened in the spring of 1970. I was born in 1970.
Are you asking me if you think I was born before 1970? Is that what you're doing?
I'm just putting it out there. Like,
you know what? I'm going to get a better moisturizer right now. That's what I'm going to do. Sorry, I interrupted because, you know.
But he had this great line. Gaylord Nelson had this great line that, you know, it's really important that we understand that the economy is a wholly owned subsidiary of the environment. And so, you know, when you think about that line, what he's saying is, if we understood that all of our health and wealth flowed from a healthy ecosystem. Again, clean air, clean water, healthy food, the joys of seeing abundant wildlife. Then we would align technology in our economy to deliver those things, as opposed to an extra 50 cents, you know, profit margin on some widget that we create. And, you know, I'm slightly naively optimistic, but I think that's possible to us if we just kind of really are diligent about doing that. And again, asking technology in our economy to deliver the things that really make life possible. Let's start there, and then kind of rich in a broad sense.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's very, very well said, is that, I mean, just look at all the billions of dollars we spend every year due to the adverse effects of climate change, you know, whether that be rebuilding Florida or this year with the hurricanes in South Carolina, North Carolina, Tennessee. So much money, that just goes from the federal government, from FEMA to people. And that's money that's just wasted, that had we taken care of it. And now, I mean, Malibu is on fire today, for instance, right, and everything. So it's, you know, it's just realizing, finding a way to connect the environment to the economy for your average person who's thinking about it. The problem is it's not an immediate hit. It's not like, if I do this, then this happens tomorrow. And it feels like the world kind of revolves around the stock market, which is all about tomorrow's gains. And there's not really an easy way around that, other than maybe to just talk about that or find a way for
that
to hit. Yeah,
I think that's right. I think, you know, more of it's conversation and just, again, kind of assessing where real value and you know, kind of wealth comes from. But it's also making sure we do point out examples. Like, most people don't really realize that New York City gets its drinking water. What is this? We're talking 10 million people get their drinking water from the Catskills, and the, you know, that it's a protected watershed where the rain falls up there, infiltrates through the ground, gets naturally cleaned. And, you know, instead of a $1 billion water treatment plant. So we have these examples of kind of ecological solutions to providing the goods and services we need. We just don't really kind of highlight them. And then, to your point, kind of put them in understanding the short-term versus long-term investments and benefits.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think it's a real art form in doing that, though, which is why I think this book continues to resonate, because it found a way to do that, not just in the time it was written, but sort of through the centuries, or not the centuries, through the decades. And I think it has certainly inspired me to think about, how do you say this in a way that people really care? But even beyond that, even forget getting other people to care, coming up with different ideas that can help fix the problem in a way that, like, immediately almost makes money. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like, if you could find a really environmentally efficient way to pull, to sequester carbon, to get carbon out of the atmosphere, you'd make a lot of money. You know, if you could find a way to remove microplastic from the water, in a sort of in a more efficient way than what it currently is, you'd make a lot of money. So it's almost like putting a bounty on these environmental problems. If you come up with a product that can do this, I think that that's interesting too, you know, and then also highlight the problem as you do it. You know.
Yeah. So you're going to solve that for us?
No, I tried. Oh. I'm not very good at it. I'm just working on building a woodworking bench out there. I don't know if you know where my handyman skills are. They're not quite there. I'm just throwing this out there for someone smarter than me to figure out, you know, or someone. Hell, if you really want to use AI, use it to figure out that situation. That'd be interesting. So anyways, before we
here's a story I want to share, Charlie, because you were talking about, you were in your wood shop, and sometimes it's great, you know, Aldo Leopold was this amazing thinker ahead of his time, but it's also good to remember he was just human like the rest of us. So he had a wood shop in his basement and built a handmade cedar strip canoe, only to realize when he was trying to get it out of the basement, it was too big to get out of the basement. So we all run into our own challenges.
I feel a lot better now about a few things. That's hilarious. So speaking of which, he kind of comes from sort of utilitarian standpoint on the environment. And to maybe put that more plain English, he's a guy who didn't see the environment isn't just here to never touch and not use. He was like, how do we use it? And how do we maintain a healthy ecosystem with it? I mean, his dad was a carpenter, a woodworker as well. So is that where that came from for him?
Yeah. I think Leopold, that's the other reason I think it comes out in his writing in St. County Almanac is he's trying to bridge these worlds of the John Muir, just fence it off, protect it. It's beautiful. We're just going to kind of look at it, but we can't touch it. And then the utilitarian mindset that was embodied, and Muir was a little bit older than Leopold. The other was Gifford Pinchot, who was the first chief of the Forest Service. And he was, all about the wise use. And Leopold tries to bridge this gap, kind of recognize, we're going to have to use resources. I mean, we are living organisms. And yet we need them to be healthy so that we're healthy. And I think it comes from a family who, had a natural resource-based business. It came from his love of hunting and fishing and hiking and just being outdoors and engaging the world. But yet also having the chance and opportunity to kind of be in some really beautiful, special places and, stop for a moment and realize, wow, this is breathtaking. How do we protect it? So that's kind of his unique role in the whole conservation environmental history is he's kind of that straddle between total use and total protection.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a kind of a good one, I think, for a lot of people to see or just to grab to you can grab onto the love for it or the economic benefits or the beauty benefits, or anyone in between, and that's the thing where even farmers resonate with Aldo Leopold. And same with conservationists.
Yeah, I often kind of use Aldo Leopold has been on the cover of Sierra magazine, which is a pretty, kind of leftist protectionist group, and also on the cover of Deer and Deer Hunting magazine. And I'm there's nobody who has been covered by both of those publications. And the story is positive about both of them. They kind of, whether you're a hunter or a vegan, there's something in Leopold that's there's something in his writing that helps me understand how I see the world and feel about it as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And where did Aldo Leopold's love for the environment come from? And when was it kind of realized for him? Give us a little bit of his backstory.
Well, so he grew up, he's born in 1887. That's a long time ago now, on the Mississippi River in Iowa. And just kind of from an early age, he loved to be outside, and his mother and father kind of encouraged him to be outside to hunt and hike. And then, as you mentioned, his family had this natural, they made furniture. So he also then saw the big cutover happen in the upper Midwest and kind of began to wonder where are these resources going to come from to keep making furniture and building houses and doing those kind of things. And that led him to a career in forestry, and that led him to the U.S. Forest Service, which was kind of an emerging conservation effort at the time in the early 1900s. And from there, he just kept getting these experiences of seeing wild places and both where they were taken good care of and where they weren't, and began developing these philosophies of how people need to recognize their connection to the natural world. And then a transfer in the Forest Service brought him back to the Midwest. And ultimately, he got to pursue his real love, which was wildlife management at the University of Wisconsin, where he was the first professor of that program in the whole country.
It's very cool to see Wisconsin somehow at the forefront of a lot of environmental movements. Like you mentioned, Gaylord Nelson, the guy who, brought up Earth Day. Aldo Leopold, John Muir had connections to Wisconsin.
Yep.
It's pretty sweet. Where did he become a good writer? Do we know that?
Well, that's a great question, too. I mean, we always say he became a good writer by writing. You know, as a communicator yourself, you could probably attest to the more you do it, the better you get.
Yeah.
And he wrote letters when he was away at school back to his parents. And then even those essays, you know, as you're thumbing through there, like he would write them and then it was called the cooler. He'd put them in his desk drawer and he'd walk away from them and then he'd come back and then he'd rewrite them. And then he was really open to challenging editing. So he'd have his wife read it. He'd have his students read it. He'd have colleagues read it and he would take that feedback. And then you can see after those edits, you know, that he would rework the essay.
Eagle 1490 AM.
ABC News, I'm Dave Packer. More mysterious drone sightings over a number of states, including New York, New Jersey, Pennsylvania, and Virginia.
The aircraft now getting the attention of public officials. Mendham Borough Mayor Christine Serrano has organized a task force to track, record, and share drone sightings.
But at this rate, they need to let us know if it's their equipment, if our government owns this. And that's it.
In a bulletin obtained by ABC News, the New Jersey Division of Fire Safety warning downed or landed drones should not be approached.
ABC's Ike Ajachi. New details on the killing of United Healthcare CEO Brian Thompson. Police now say the suspect did not take a bus, took the train to Pennsylvania. And we've learned that the FBI and NYPD spoke to Luigi Mangione's mother a day before he was arrested. American Travis Timmerman handed over to the U.S. after months in a Syrian prison. But there's no word yet on the whereabouts of American Austin Tice. This is ABC News.
This is your local Civic Media radio station. Want to hear even more? Anytime? Find all of it at civicmedia.us.
A win for Badgers volleyball. Hi, I'm Mike Clemens with sports. The Wisconsin women's volleyball team came back last night to eliminate Texas A&M 3-2 in the NCAA regionals. The Badgers will play Nebraska Sunday at 2 p.m. carried on ABC TV. The Cornhuskers beat the Badgers twice during a regular season. NBA, the Bucks and the Atlanta Hawks today in the NBA Cup semifinals as the tournament gets underway in Las Vegas. Baseball, the Brewers say it's a good deal. They traded away closer Devin Williams to the New York Yankees in exchange for two players, left-handed pitcher Nestor Cortez, infielder Caleb During, and for cash consideration. The 30-year-old Williams was with the Brewers for 6 years. NFL, Packers headed to Seattle to face the Seahawks tomorrow night. Defensive back Jair Alexander, still dealing with a knee injury, was not at practice yesterday.
Why wasn't he there?
Just based on what I saw over the last couple days, didn't feel like he's ready to play.
So will he be out then this week?
Yeah.
That's Packers head coach Matt LaFleur with sports. I'm Mike Clemens.
The holidays are here, and it's nearly time to pick a present from our grown-up gift list with our Civic Media statewide text to win contest. Listen while you work for the keywords to text for your chance to win 100.
Lacrosse area weather. I'm Corey Hartman. Winter weather advisory today. Snow and freezing rain and a little bit breezy as well. Highs in the mid-30s. For tonight, snow and drizzle coming to an end later with a low around 32. Tomorrow, mostly cloudy. Highs near 40 degrees. More rain and snow Monday.
Right now, 31 degrees.
It's the center of the Kringle-making world. Racine County wears the crown, and bakers like those at O&H create more than 10,000 of the delicate oval-shaped pastry every single day.
Just a great pastry. One that's hard to make, though. Hard to replicate.
Peter Olison is a third-generation owner. O&H is celebrating its 75th year, but do you know if Wisconsin considers the Kringle our official pastry? The answer coming up.
The 500-square-foot corner bakery to offering our products by mail.
Baker Mike Massanellis says their Kringle is shipped near and far. The tradition began when the Danes came to Racine in the late 1800s, and it is that past and present which created our official state pastry, the Kringle, in 2013. And it's a you can't have just one slice of Wisconsin. I'm Terry Barr for the Civic Media Radio Network.
The possibility of lung cancer can be pretty scary, especially if you're one of approximately 8 million current or former smokers at high risk. That's why SaveByTheScan.org wants you to know that now there's a breakthrough low-dose CT scan that can detect lung cancer early, and it only takes 60 seconds. You stop smoking, now start screening. For an easy quiz to see if you're eligible, visit SaveByTheScan.org. It could save your life. SavedByTheScan.org is brought to you by the American Lung Association's Lung Force Initiative and the Ad Council.
Nightlight with Pete Schwabba.
Here's why I'm glad I don't work in an office. My wife is always talking about, she's a teacher. They put donuts in the teacher's lounge, there's sweets, there's snacks. It wasn't that way here today, but Nikki keeps those Biscoff cookies out there. I probably ate 12 of those today. The phrase "you are what you eat" is very true, because I was sitting in the office earlier prepping the show and I felt kind of doughy and I'm like, I feel like a Biscoff cookie.
Nightlight with Pete Schwabba. Weeknights from 6 till 8 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the Civic Media app. Earl Ingram.
Mr. Ben Wickler, he is running for the National.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
Hey, folks, I'm Charlie Behrens. This is Civic Media, and here's my conversation with the president and executive director of the Aldo Leopold Foundation, Buddy Heffaker. Where did he, like, become a good writer? Do we know that?
He was really open to challenging editing. So he'd have his wife read it. He'd have his students read it. He'd have colleagues read it. And he would take that feedback. And then you can see after those edits, you know, that he would rework the essay. So it was really kind of a labor of love in that he put the time and energy into, you know, coming up with the content, putting it on paper, letting it digest, then taking feedback and constantly improving it.
That's really cool as a writer listening to that process. And, you know, I think that's what he wasn't just throwing the first thing out of his mind saying this will connect with people. He was testing it hard with people. And that's what I think made this thing go from just his ideas about the environment to actually resonating with people. As he tested it like that.
You know, you're exactly right. And one of the things I love is, again, when you kind of get deeper into Leopold and you see his other writings, some of which then would get reshaped and ultimately appear in a St. County Almanac. You know, when he's writing for the Garden Club, he expresses these ideas in one way. When he's writing to the Civil Engineering Department, it's different. When it's to a general hunting audience, it's different. And so, you know, kind of knowing your audience, sometimes we forget about, we just try to, like you say, come up with that one right line and think it's going to work everywhere. And, you know, we got to connect with those people we're really trying to reach and communicate in a way that they're going to be interested and willing to receive it.
Yeah. And I think one of his best tools in doing that is coming from his own admission that he's messed things up himself. And that would be in, it's one of my favorite essays, but it's like Thinking Like a Mountain, you know, that's kind of like, that's the big one. But this is basically a story where he kills a wolf. And because back then you saw wolves, you'd kill them, you know, because less wolves meant more deer. And the ending of it, I think, first of all, yeah, I mean, I'd almost want to read the whole freaking thing, but I won't. I just want to read the ending of it because I think this is really cool. We all strive for safety, prosperity, comfort, long life, and dullness. The deer strives with his supple legs, the cowman with trap and poison, the statesman with pen, the most of us with machines, votes, and dollars. But it all comes to the same thing, peace in our time, a measure of success in this is all well enough and perhaps is a requisite to objective thinking, but too much safety seems to yield only danger in the long run. Perhaps this is behind Thoreau's dictum, in wilderness is the salvation of the world. Perhaps this is the hidden meaning in the howl of the wolf, long known among mountains, but seldom perceived among men. I think it's so freaking cool because it basically, says, you know, like, we need wolves. Like, without wolves, the land goes to shit. And the deer you're even trying to save, they go to shit. Or the cattle you're trying to preserve, they go to shit. And also, the wolf is kind of that natural regulator. Maybe that wolf is getting your deer because that needs to happen in order to save more of the deer. And we see that with chronic wasting disease. And we see that with sort of the overgrazing of certain lands and what happens to those lands. They get degraded. So it's almost like the thing that was here before us knows more than us, that being the mountain and the general environment.
Well, again, I love what you're picking up on. I think that's one of the other beauties is I kind of sometimes describe a Sand County Almanac as like you're going for a walk with your grandfather in the woods, right? He's kind of like pointing things out and you're learning these lessons. It's not real preachy, but there's always kind of some education that happens. But then in other parts of the book, he kind of puts you, and this is challenging to do, but he kind of helps you try to see the world from the deer's eyes or from the mountain's eyes. And so like all of a sudden, like, wow, like, this is challenging. Like, it's not just how I see the world. Like, I got to start to think of these other vantage points. And I think that was relatively new at the time Leopold was writing that kind of device to put people outside of themselves and try to understand their world around them. And then, yeah, the core point of that whole essay is that, you know, is kind of to reveal he had blood on his hands. He didn't always behave exactly perfect or know the right way to behave. But as he learned, he was able to improve and refine his thinking and actions.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that's kind of the humility that a lot of people in the environmental world don't often have, you know, because it's easy to get. And I would say I could be just as guilty of not only doing the bad environmental stuff, but being all, feeling like I'm doing the right thing and other people aren't about it just as much as anybody. But so I think it's good to see that sort of admission of it in this book. And the phrase like the most of us with machines and votes and dollars, that hasn't changed at all. So it's fun to see like the timelessness in this thing, especially 75 years now. I don't know why I just looked at my watch when I said 75 years from now. Like I was trying to
how much time has it been long since we started talking, Charlie?
No. It's just I anytime I am talking about time, I reflexively look at my watch.
You know, one of the other neat things about the book and its legacy that has been fun to kind of reflect on and highlight this year is your point about kind of Wisconsin leading the world and kind of being this ability to kind of attract people's attention and consideration. And, you know, the book has been translated into 16 different languages now. So, you know, Leopold, and when you read the book, it is very Wisconsin focused. I mean, if you've lived in this state very long, there are images that he will describe like, oh, yeah, I saw that. I saw that up north. Or I saw that down by Madison or driving to Milwaukee. And so he's literally taken Wisconsin to the world now through these translations and other people in other parts of the world trying to think about these conceptual aspects about how we relate to each other in the natural world, but also getting this glimpse into what life in Wisconsin might be like and what a cool place it would be. And we literally have people come from all over the world now to see the farm and the landscape that inspired that book.
That's pretty cool. So tell me about that, by the way. Tell me about the farm and tell me like when Aldo bought it and what it was before and what it is now.
So he was teaching at the university. They had a hunting cabin down in Arkansas, and that was, of course, a stretch to get down there at that point. And so they were looking for a little farm where the family could go on the weekends. And they found 35 crummy little acres along the Wisconsin River, kind of equidistant between Baraboo, Portage, and Wisconsin Dells, for those that know that region. And they bought it. There was basically no vegetation on the property. The farmer had lost the land to the bank for back taxes. It's on pure sand, effectively, from the Wisconsin River. And there was this one little structure on it. There was a chicken coop because literally there was frozen chicken manure in it with the first time they went to visit it. And they kind of cleaned it up and it became what they called the shack. It was just enough to get them out of the elements. And then they started planting thousands and thousands of trees, restored prairie, planted a sugar maple grove and kind of restored it back to health. It's looked at as one of the early ecological restoration projects in the world. Replicating some of the stuff that was happening at the University of Wisconsin Arboretum. And that's kind of his, you know, he'd been a public servant with the Forest Service. He'd been an educator. Now here he's just a regular old guy trying to take care of the farm, having to pay for all the work and, you know, maintain the property. And he begins to realize that, hey, this conservation thing is going to take everybody. And so that's when he starts writing these essays that are designed to reach, he'd been writing technical papers. These essays were designed to reach more general audiences and engage people in these ideas. And so it's that kind of intersection of the family farm and its restoration with trying to reach a bigger audience that inspires him to write the book.
And he wrote it right before his death, right?
Yeah. So he'd worked on it for almost 15 years, been rejected 4 to 5 times, kind of depends on how you read, either rejection letters or no responses. And yeah, 1 week before he passed away of a heart attack at the age of 61, he finally received word from Oxford University Press that they would publish his manuscript. So
wow,
he very nearly never saw it. Well, and actually never saw it in print. He almost didn't even know it was going to be printed.
And he died fighting a fire, didn't he, on his buddy's
land? Yeah, so the shack and farm is along the Wisconsin River. It's now National Historic Landmark. The site where he passed away is where the Leopold Center now stands. And we kind of, it's our offices and interpretive center. People come here before they go down to the shack. And we have a memorial site where he suffered a heart attack. There was a farmhouse here. A brush fire escaped, and he and his wife and youngest daughter came over to help suppress the fire. They kind of broke up. Leopold suffered a heart attack and died while trying to suppress the fire to protect it from kind of getting out of control. So
it's the most Midwest way to go out, man.
Right, exactly.
Yeah. I'll come over and help you fight that fire. No problem. Oh, there we go. Who was it? Was it Curly Lambeau? I think Curly Lambeau also died cutting his neighbor's grass, I think.
No kidding. Yeah,
I think so. I think
communitarian, civic minded individuals that.
That's the way you want to go out. You know?
Yeah,
that's nice.
By the way, since I know the Packers are a strong theme through your programs.
Yeah.
The best we know is that in 1937, Aldo Leopold did not know who the Packers were, because he asked his son, Starker, who was listening to a game on the radio, who are these Packers? So
really,
he wasn't clued in quite yet. I don't know if that changed in the last decade of his life.
How did you know that? Was that in his journals?
It's a story that, yeah, his oldest son, Starker, would tell.
That's fun. That's
so
funny.
So the kids knew who the Packers were. They weren't all that clueless.
So how does it work now? I mean, his kids have all since passed, but you are sort of in control of all his writings and everything. Is that accurate or no?
So then, yeah, 1980, all five of the kids were amazing scientists and conservationists in their own right. They all had decorated careers. We just lost the youngest child, Estella, this last year at the age of 97. So they were, productive for long periods of time in their own disciplines. But in 1982, kind of recognizing that their father's work was just becoming more and more important, they created the Aldo Leopold Foundation, and they entrusted it with two assets. One was the farm, and the other was the rights to their father's writing. So the Leopold Foundation, now that operates out of Baraboo in the Leopold Center, we continue to own and manage the farm, and we work with neighboring landowners to kind of manage about 4,000 acres for wildlife habitat purposes. We have people come to see the shack from all over the world and kind of learn what happened there and the history of this book and the idea of a land ethic. And then we're the executor of his literary estate. So we help bring the book out in new languages and new formats and, just keep the idea alive.
Who's got like his he wrote a bunch of journals and all that sort of stuff. Where's all that stuff with?
Most of that is held at the University of Wisconsin in Madison in the Steenbach Library. So they house the physical connection. We've digitized all of that. So if you want to go thumb through his journals, it's all digitized and transcribed on their website. And then we have a few of them on display at the center just, for demonstration purposes.
That's crazy that, did he say he wanted his journals published? Is there any weird stuff in there?
You know, we keep looking. We haven't found anything.
He probably put those in a different box.
Maybe. Yeah. Those were destroyed at some point.
Burned in that fire or something. That's really interesting that you can go do that, though. Roughly how many pages are we talking if you wanted to read everything he had ever written?
Oh my goodness. I should know that. It's a lot.
Have you read it all? Have you read everything?
Well, there are scholars who have. I have read a fair amount of it and kind of dipped in and out, but I get to use their scholarship and research so that I haven't had to read every word.
Yeah, gotcha. Gotcha. That's a lot. That's a lot.
Yeah.
It's very cool to see. And then you got your start. What was your personal journey?
So I grew up in Central Illinois. I'm not sure if I'm allowed to admit that, though I do have my own Packer origin story. My second grade teacher, as I tell the story, so my mother just kind of refuted this. So I'll put it out here to your audience. Maybe somebody can help vet this, though. If I'm wrong, I'm going to be really shattered and disappointed. But my second grade teacher, Mrs. Levante in Champaign, Illinois, was, as I say it, was Bart Starr's niece.
Oh.
So from, though I was in Bears country, from second grade on, I have been a Packers fan. Back to Lynn Dickey and Randy White and, you know, James Lofton, James Jefferson. I was a Packers fan through and through. So,
buddy, you made a good decision.
Yeah. Thankfully now. Any rate, I was a pretty suburban kid and in high school, got a random job at a soil testing laboratory because it paid well. And in the 80s, there weren't many summer jobs. And I got interested in soil science and agronomy. And so then went to Purdue University and studied kind of landscape architecture and plant ecology. And then went to the University of Illinois for graduate school because Madison wouldn't give me any money. So That was
Midwest cheap.
Yep. And, you know, it turned out good. I went to school in Illinois and get to live in Wisconsin. If I would have gone to school up here, who knows? Maybe I would have had to live in Chicago. That'd be terrible. And I came to the Leopold Foundation right as Nina Leopold Bradley, one of Aldo's children who had retired back to the area and kind of been the family storyteller and convener for decades, was ready for her second retirement. And I was supposed to be here for a field season, and 28 years later, they haven't figured out how to get rid of me.
Oh, that's good. That's very good. You've evaded it that long, huh?
Yeah.
You must be doing a real good job there. So congratulations on that. What do you see as, so you guys, you're preserving the works, you're preserving and spreading sort of a Sand County Almanac and other works of Aldo Leopold around, and you are preserving the land. And what other initiatives do you guys see as important? Like, if you were to have unlimited money and take on maybe another thing, what would you say are the biggest environmental concerns right now?
Well, so for starters, we don't preserve the land. You really only preserve pickles and we try to manage the land.
Manage it. Yes, of course. Yeah, yes.
Because it's a dynamic system. And then another important project I want to get out there is we have a program called My Wisconsin Woods, where we're helping woodland landowners all across the state of Wisconsin kind of understand what they can do on their own property, whether it's 5 acres or 500 acres, to have a healthy forest, do sustainable forestry practices, better wildlife management activities. And so we're connecting landowners up all across the state with different resources in their area and kind of helping to illuminate what they can and might want to consider doing to meet their own kind of management objectives, whether it be for deer habitat or songbird habitat or forest productivity. But there's a lot of resources of landowners out there that they don't know about. And so we try to kind of be the connector of those dots out there.
Well, that's really incredible right there. I know you're about to mention something else, but before you, if you could hold that thought and we could just say, let's say someone has a piece of land, how much is, let's say you just have a backyard. Is that big enough to get in contact?
So one of our partners for this project is Wisconsin DNR. And for the criteria to be eligible for some of their programs, you have to have 5 acres or more.
Okay.
So that's kind of our threshold. For this program. It doesn't mean that if you have less, there isn't some good information that we share. So we have an e-newsletter and a website. But then what we do is kind of actively, wherever there are needs or opportunities across the state, like if you remember that big blowdown from the straight line winds up in northern Wisconsin a couple of years ago.
Yes, yes,
we really helped. Like we have a database of all the landowners in the state, and we helped landowners up there understand the state and federal programs that could help them clean up their woods and salvage the timber and those kind of things. You know, we only have limited capacity, so we try to work where the need or the opportunity is greatest. But otherwise, we have background education and information going out to landowners all across the state. So anybody interested in that should check out the website, My Wisconsin Woods, and sign up for the e-newsletter, because once a month we have all sorts of programs you could sign up for, classes you could take, or, you know, just information about your woods that might be helpful and relevant to you.
That's great. And so kind of whatever you want to do with your woods, you guys can kind of cater it to that, you know, sort of within reason, you know, if you want to probably
Well, like my point is people aren't preserving their woods. They own it for a reason. They either want to hunt on it, or they want to hike on it, or they need to get income off of it. All of those, if done as, you know, right, have ecological benefits and opportunities. And so we want to connect people up with those, just help them be intentional about, okay, if this is what the values I want to get off the land, how do I do that best, you know, most ecologically sensitive and thoughtfully?
Yeah. Yeah. And that's a real good distinction between preserving and utilizing that. But that's right back to Aldo Leopold of being sort of a utilitarian with the land. And the more people that do, even if you want to farm or log or whatever, if you do that the right way, it's going to be a net win.
Yeah.
That's really cool. And then what was the other thing you were going to say before I interrupted?
Well,
you?
I think, you know, if unlimited budget, different opportunities. One, we just give a copy of a Sand County Almanac to everybody in the state of Wisconsin and beyond, you know, just to get them to read and think about the world in these ways. And then the other would be, again, what we talked about is just finding these alignments of economic need and opportunity with ecological systems. So my model was the New York City drinking water. But again, it would be continuing to produce valuable timber resources in the state of Wisconsin that drive our economy and create the land health, keep the land healthy and create recreational opportunities. And so, you know, that innovation between of connecting ecological integrity with economic opportunity is a space that just needs more time, investment, and thought.
No, I love that. Yeah. So it would just be finding different ways of finding those things and connecting it with people and sort of being creative with it.
So right now we have a collaboration with the U.S. Forest Service in the eastern region, which is basically Minnesota to Missouri, over to Maryland and up to Maine. So a pretty good chunk of the country. And that's what we're looking for, these stories of where communities are coming together and kind of improving land management practices to provide ecological and cultural values that you know, return to the bigger community. And like one project or effort's called Wild Harvest. And it's about how, berries and hunting and fishing produce not only dietary and caloric needs for communities, but also create local economies that need to be protected and enhanced. So that's kind of what we're on the hunt for right now, is where this is happening out there. The Menominee Forest is a great example in Wisconsin of the Menominee Nation that has managed their forest for generations. The forest is healthier than a lot of the surrounding forests. So again, when done right, you get healthy land and you get a healthy economy.
Folks, that's all for now. But if you want to listen to my full conversation with Buddy, just check out the Cripescast anywhere you get your podcasts.
So roll out the barrel and get the band brewing. Life's got you down, just keep her moving. It's on Wisconsin, the Badgers say it's the old Wisconsin Jubilee.
You know, sometimes when you're ice fishing, you put your foot into walleye hole and go ass over tea kettle and you think you're done. No. Gotta keep her moving.
You're listening to The Eagle, WLCX, Lacrosse's home for Up North News Radio.
Dom Selvia.
I'm Jimmy Cuska, filling in for Dom Selvia. Coming up Monday, we'll talk gas prices heading into the holidays, and it's not too late to run for local office. We'll tell you how.
The Dom Selvia Show, weekdays 4 till 6.
Uh-oh, Brad's buzzed.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, he's starting with the woots. And now a speech.
I just want to say that friendship is about heart. Heart and brain. Who's with me?
Good thing is, he knows when he's buzzed.
And my brain is saying, when it's time to go home, somebody call me a ride.
Love that guy.
Me too.
Know your buzzed warning signs? Call for a ride when it's time to go home. Buzz driving is drunk driving. A message from NHTSA and the Ad Council.
Local radio for you and your community. It's Civic Media's mission with stations across, soaring high above Lacrosse. This is Eagle 1490 AM WLCX Lacrosse and streaming everywhere on the Civic Media app.
ABC News, I'm Dave Packer. Sources telling ABC News that a task force comprised of FBI agents and NYPD detectives spoke to Luigi Mangione's mother one day before he was arrested in Pennsylvania and named the suspect in the shooting death of United Healthcare CEO Brian Thompson. New details about the last days of the brutal regime of Bashar al-Assad in Syria.
U.S. officials believe Russian Foreign Minister Lavrov played a major role in getting him to Russia. He didn't tell any of his aides, and he boarded a plane with a disabled transponder so he could escape without being tracked.
ABC's James Longman in Syria. Today, Secretary of State Antony Blinken confirming for the first time that the U.S. has made direct contact with HTS, the rebel group that overthrew Assad, a designated terror organization. A person was arrested after attempting to climb temporary fencing near the White House this morning. Secret Service says there was no impact to any protectees. The climber taken to Metro Police for processing. This is ABC News.